On the phone now is Peter Smeyrud. He's the executive director of Wolf Ridge Environmental Learning Center in Finland. Good evening, Peter.
Hello, Kathy.
Thanks for joining us tonight.
Oh,
I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure to be here. Yeah.
Kind of on short notice, we were going to speak with Jackie Fallon, and she's the Minnesota State Coordinator for Peregrine Falcons, but she lost her voice. So that doesn't make for very good radio.
No, that would be a bit tough, and hopefully she'll recover for tomorrow night.
Yeah, she's supposed to be giving a talk down at Sugarloaf Cove tomorrow night at 7 p.m., but you were gracious enough to step in and help talk about peregrines to get folks ready for tomorrow night's event. So thanks again. Exactly. I appreciate it.
Oh, and my pleasure. An easy subject for me and a great story.
Well, why don't we start out by giving a little background about peregrine falcons and their plight, their difficulties back in the 50s and 60s, and how their recovery has gone.
Yeah, and it is an amazing story from where it was to where it has now come, and that in the days of the 1930s, for example, there was 7,000 to 10,000 in North America, and they first noticed the worldwide decline probably in the late 40s. And then there's a lot of survey work done, especially in the Midwest in the 50s and 60s. And by 1964, there were no peregrines existing in the eastern United States.
Hmm. Okay.
It's just astonishing.
Yeah.
And that it was back at a conference held in Wisconsin in 1965, where really the worldwide effects of DDT and some other pesticides were discussed, primarily DDT and DDE, and that in 30 years there had been almost a 90% decline.
And how widespread was the population prior to the DDT and the DDE?
Oh, good question. You know, I can't answer that exactly. I know Jackie will be able to, but I know quite prevalently throughout the eastern and really eastern and western United States, wherever you could find good cliff structure, as peregrines need to nest on a cliff-like structure. Nowadays, of course, there could be buildings, et cetera. And so if you got into really flat, sort of open country, you're not going to find peregrines. But as soon as you could get some relief, mountains, et cetera, well, that extends, down the whole eastern slope with the Appalachians and through a great portion of our country, you can find that sort of habitat in almost any state. I don't know exactly if it was in every single state, but I know Jackie will know that.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so what happened? How did we get these birds back on track?
Well, it was, of course, noting that, and for I think people know this, but the idea that it wasn't that the DDT was poisoning the bird directly that was causing the decline. It was a bioaccumulation, and where that DDT would accumulate in that bird's body to the point that it thinned the eggshells, and so the eggshells would literally crush under the weight of an incubating female. And so it caused that sort of secondary decline. That's part of what took it so long. And yet it was then in the 70s where people really started, and falconers began starting to raise birds in captivity, get hatchlings, and then start to experiment with a concept called hacking, or releasing hatch-raised young baby peregrines in captivity and releasing them into the wild, which then occurred up in the North Shore that came to the North Shore in the mid-80s.
So if I understand correctly, the peregrine falcons were not dying from DDT, but they were just not able to reproduce because of this chemical making their eggs weak, and they didn't have good success rate?
You nailed it, Kathy.
Okay.
Right on the nose there.
I did not understand that until now. You described it very well. So they made this miraculous rebound, and this was in the 70s. What kind of numbers do we have today, as far as we know?
Well, that, for example, to give it to people, WA listeners here, there are currently, this past summer, there were 21 nesting pairs on the North Shore from the Canadian border down to Duluth, and another 3 in Duluth proper, where up until the late 80s, when we first started to reintroduce them, there were no nesting birds on that entire zone. And so I don't know about Minnesota completely, but I would estimate that there's probably 40 nest sites in Minnesota now, and a lot of those are on the North Shore. And then going down through the Twin Cities, there's a lot of urban peregrines living on the buildings in the metro area, down along the bluffs of Lake Pepin in that area, for example. So the comeback has been tremendous.
And they return to the same nest, I gather?
It is interesting. You know, when we started to reintroduce them here, it was points like Laveau Mountain near Tofte, and here at Wolf Ridge on Marshall Mountain, and up in Virginia in some mine pits, and they were really sort of inland sites, where I think it was convenient, and the humans said, these are good cliff sites. We where the birds now have naturally, even though they released there, have all moved down to the shoreline. And along the North Shore, for example, you really don't find any peregrine nests except right on the shoreline, which is the natural habitat where they would have always preferred to have been 100-plus years ago before all of this really impacted them.
Okay. Can you talk about the birds itself? I understand they migrate. Where do they go?
Oh, they go south to Central America, northern South America. Jackie, maybe I'll give the listeners who go to the program tomorrow night at Sugarloaf a better idea. I don't know exactly, but in general, like a lot of those raptors are going into Central America. I believe there's peregrines that will spend, perhaps, you know, will overwinter down Texas area, something like that. They need to get to food source, and of course, they're falcons, so they feed on other birds.
Okay.
They feed on smaller birds. Well, in peregrine's case, it could be something as large as, say, a mallard, not so small birds, or even a gull. But blue jays, flickers, that type of thing, are often a bird of prey that they a prey species that they will take.
And so, I assume then that they're not going to be back in our area until we see significant migration of other birds.
Well, and you know that we have some birds like that, blue jays, for example, that are around here all winter. And yet, the reason, of course, that they are returning here is for reproduction. They're coming north to nest, and they will follow food supply. That's quite true, but really, any day now that you could start to expect the possibility of a peregrine sighting, and by late April, assuredly, we'll be seeing peregrines on the North Shore.
I'm curious, back to your the topic of the bioaccumulation of the DDT and the DDE, why doesn't that affect other birds? Why are only peregrine eggs adversely affected?
Oh, good biology question, and I'm not certain I know the answer okay. to that one. I believe that other creatures were affected, and of course bioaccumulation is that concept that, say, a small amount of DDT, and perhaps that may accumulate in a grasshopper, that then a blue jay eats 100 grasshoppers, and a peregrine eats 10 blue jays. You can see the math coming out that the peregrine accumulates that same amount of DDT at a much greater amount in its body through that act of that DDT or whatever it may be, mercury, for example, in loons or something like that. That's a good example of bioaccumulation. Again, for a species that's on the higher end of the food chain, they're pulling all of this lower end of the food chain up to them. It happened in the peregrine's case. It affected the calcification of the eggshells.
Okay.
Yeah. Does that make sense?
It does make sense, strangely, but you explained it very well. we're speaking with Peter Smeyrud. He's the executive director of Wolf Ridge Environmental Learning Center in Finland. Tomorrow night, there's going to be a talk about peregrine falcons at Sugarloaf Cove Nature Center just outside of Schroeder. And so we're kind of getting you warmed up for tomorrow night's talk at Sugarloaf Cove. It's at 7. Peter, I understand that you have had the, you've actually been up close to some of these peregrine nests.
I could say I've been up or down many, many cliffs for those peregrine nests, or as a biologist would call for a falcon like that, their eyrie is the name of a falcon nest on a cliff like that. And so it is, their preferred site would be along a cliff site such as this, and we will, typically in June, when the chicks are, say, around 12, 18 days old, that we will rappel or lower down into those nests. We'll borrow the chicks for a short period of time, send them up top where we'll gather some blood. We'll do aging and sexing of the birds, gather some data on them, assign a name to them. They'll send them back to me on the cliff. I'll place them back in the nest, and we'll sit there and hopefully track that population, the identity of those birds, and over time.
Wow, that's quite a job. How did you land that position?
Well, I've been doing it since 87, helping with the project. And back then it was just releasing these young birds. And then the first birds nested at Palisade Head, I believe it was in 89. Jackie, you'll know this stat. And as the biologists from the University of Minnesota, places like that, were working on this project, and they wanted to get to these nest sites, they instantly kind of realized this challenge of, oh my gosh, Palisade Head, how do we get there? Well, Wolf Ridge was nearby, and they needed climbers, and I was a climber, and I was also a biologist who had handled raptors in college, owls and falcons and hawks and things like that, so it was that combination of skills they were looking for and being in the right place at the right time.
So I bet you have quite a few interesting stories during those adventures.
Oh, Oh, yes, they're peregrines just like humans. All have their own little personality traits.
Are they rather protective, I would assume?
You are completely correct. And everyone, males and females, will raise a racket like we wouldn't believe and are screeching at you and swooping by you. And some will sit a little bit further out and screech, and some will come in and downright will thump you a little bit to let you know that they're there.
And that's one of their techniques for taking down prey, I understand.
Exactly. And, you know, again, that interesting fact of noting for folks the difference in the raptor world, that falcons are those that kill on the wing. So they're not going to go down and pick up a snake off the ground or something like that. They're killing other birds for food. And they hit them typically close-fisted. And so they come in at blistering speeds. You know, that they can do over 200 miles in a stoop or a dive to hit that prey, knock them then tumbling through the sky, perhaps if it's lower speed, grab them, but knock them, swoop around, and then grab them. Where they may not be big enough, strong enough to just grab this thing out of the sky, they really have to hit it hard, close-fisted, to first disorient it, so then they can swoop around and grab it.
How do they actually obtain such high speeds?
Well, you know, imagine if you're a bit fast anyway, and then you're built for speed. If you look at this wingspan and the design of the wings and the body of a peregrine, it looks like an F-16, a sort of, you know, fighter jet design. It really is quite different than an eagle or a red-tailed hawk or things like that. And then if you go from hundreds and hundreds of feet up in the air and you literally just tuck your wings and bullet for whatever object you're going after, that's where they pick up the speed. It's not that they can actually fly that fast, but they can dive that fast through just sort of gravity feeding them in, and they work in gravity and also the positioning in the air to hit their prey. And then at the last minute, they throw those talons out in front of them and slam into that prey object.
It's fascinating.
It is cool.
We think we're so smart. You look around at all these other creatures, and it's like, yeah, I'm not so sure about us.
there's people that have termed that to see a large falcon in a stoop is one of the great wonders of nature. Mm. And it is just awe-inspiring to see that sort of power and yet finesse to be able to seek out, see, and attain your prey in such a skillful way.
Well, and some of those birds are pretty small. I mean, warblers, I mean, they're very small and fast, too.
To give perspective that, you know, when we go down into the nest, you can see the prey remains. And then, you know, and to call it a nest is actually kind of giving the peregrine a little more credit than due. It is not much of a nest. It is a rocky ledge, often referred to as a scrape, and it's just a little bit of dirt and some pebbles and oftentimes an old raven's nest they may use. That it isn't anything dramatic that they've created there, but of course it's safe and away from predators and things like that. And we get kind of rough on the North Shore. This past June, that huge storm we had took out dozens of chicks at sites. I think there were 11 known fatalities this last June just during that big storm.
They're a little vulnerable. For those of us who like to look for these kinds of nests. Can you talk a little bit about the difference? How do I tell a raven's nest from a peregrine nest?
Oh, great question. A raven's nest is always sticks.
Okay.
So a raven's nest will be wedged into a rock or a cliff, and it will be a cluster of sticks, sometimes quite large, with possibly some vegetation or you know, smaller sticks or rotten sticks in the middle that give kind of a soft depression in the middle. Where a peregrine nest, again, there isn't much to see. The best thing is people who see kayak or out on the big lake in boats are the ones who are the best to see these nests, and they are just noted by all the whitewash, all the excrement from the birds. It creates this huge white stain on the ledge and dripping down from the ledge below it, and that's what the identity will be of a nest site typically.
And do ravens have that same excrement?
Yes,
they do.
In general.
Okay.
In general,
okay.
They do. Ravens nest earlier. Gulls nest a little bit later, so on the same cliff set. You won't really see ravens as much with peregrines, as the ravens are pretty tenacious and will often chase the peregrines away, and if the peregrines are setting up their nesting later in the season, that an already existing defending pair of ravens may chase the peregrines away to another site. But I've seen peregrines nesting almost right next to herring gulls and things like that, and herring gulls' chicks who may become the prey of these peregrine chicks in not too long,
right?
As the gulls are first learning to fly.
Well, it's a good thing those gulls have strength in numbers. Exactly. We're talking with Peter Smayrud. He's the executive director of Wolf Ridge Environmental Learning Center. And if you're enjoying the conversation, we invite you or encourage you to look into the Sugarloaf Cove free talk that's taking place tomorrow night about peregrine falcons on the North Shore specifically. And that's at 7 o'clock tomorrow at Sugarloaf Cove. And hopefully if Jackie Fallon finds her voice again, she will be giving that talk. Otherwise, I think they'll have somebody else sit in. But Peter, anything else while we've got you on the line here you want to share about these wonderful birds?
A couple things about the talk tomorrow night. Not only is it Jackie, not only is it going to be great images and stories of peregrine falcon recovering the North Shore, but Jackie will also have a live peregrine with her that evening on the glove.
Cool.
And so that is an amazing sight to see, the Elvis Presley bird. And you'll have to go to find out why I said that. And
Is that a peregrine at Wolf Ridge?
It is indeed.
Okay,
Kathy.
I was there just a couple weeks ago and I saw it.
We saw it too. It's very nice. We have a peregrine named Chup, and that's often what's termed as the sound they make. That's the name Chup. Mm-hmm. The peregrine that will be with Jackie tomorrow night is Jesse, who is a relatively young male from southeastern Minnesota that was injured as it grew in the nest. I can't remember exactly the injury type, something relative to the foot. And so it can't survive in the wild, and that's like the birds at Wolf Ridge. What Jackie's doing is using the Jesse then as an education bird to help people learn a little affective learning, a little touch of the heart as well as the head with bringing a live bird into the program.
Fantastic. Peter, we thank you so much for your time tonight. And, take care and good luck with your endeavors at Wolf Ridge.
My pleasure. Thank you, Kathy. Have a great evening.
You too.